You're tuned to 103.5 WCOMLP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro's 100-watt wonder. Listener-supported community radio.
You're listening to Psych Talk.
PsychTalkRadio.com.
I'm your host, Jose Drost Lopez. We're talking, of course, about marijuana and psychedelics, and we'll be speaking with Brad Burge at the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. To kick off the hour, I'm introducing my co-host, Derek Yates. Derek, you want to introduce him for us?
Certainly. Today we'll be speaking with Brad Burge, the Director of Communications at MAPS. Brad earned his Bachelor of Arts in Communication and Psychology from Stanford University in 2005. And his Master of Arts in Communication from the University of California, San Diego, in 2009. His graduate work focused on the political, scientific, and cultural changes required to make illicit drugs into legitimate medicines. In 2009, he presented his work on the history of the distinction between the recreational and medical use of drugs at the Critical Legal Studies Conference at the University of Leicester in the UK.
Thanks for that, Derek. All right, Brad, can you hear us?
I sure can.
Let's just get right into it. First, I'm going to talk about the big picture with you. Mm-hmm. You've studied the history of the distinction between recreational and medical drugs. So tell us a bit about that history, because it's going to help inform our discussion.
Yeah, great. Well, it's a really interesting question, and in order to understand it, it really takes an interdisciplinary approach. So looking at how drugs have been used and treated and thought about across history up until the present day really requires us to take scientific evidence as well as anthropology and history and all of these things and really weave them together to understand them, you know, in as many different perspectives as possible. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just to break it down really fast, that the distinction between this idea of a recreational use of drugs and a medical use of drugs really only emerged in the last couple of hundred years. So really around the 1800s, when synthetic drugs and synthetic chemistry first started to come about. The idea that some uses of drugs were purely for recreation and that that was bad, versus the idea that other drugs could be used for medical or therapeutic purposes and that was good, is really only a recent development. Just looking at the present day, just from that perspective, you know, this idea that there's no inherent therapeutic value to drugs that can make you feel good is something that can be called into question and worked with a little bit. Now, I also focused in my graduate work a little bit on the different changes that have taken place over history and that mm-hmm. are taking place now that are kind of starting to blur that distinction a little bit. And we certainly see that in medical marijuana, where we have a recreational substance that's now once again being understood as a therapeutic substance.
Right. That's very fascinating that there is that sort of blending happening between recreation and therapy that's reversing this trend we've seen for 100 years. Tell us a little bit more about that, because, you know, most people aren't going to find psychedelics under the Christmas tree a week from now. And I think that has something to do with the U.S. legal system. So tell us a little bit more about the status quo and what sort of changes would be necessary to push along medical uses of marijuana and psychedelics.
Well, right now, politically and scientifically and culturally are the areas that are really going to need to shift. First of all, politically, the way that these drugs are treated in the Western legal system presents a problem for research and for people who want to use these drugs in therapeutic ways. Because these drugs, psychedelics and marijuana, are defined as drugs with no therapeutic value and drugs that can only be used in abusive or harmful ways, that really restricts the ways that people can think about them and the way that scientists can design new studies, and really the way that the general public even thinks about the possibility for positive uses of those drugs. So politically is definitely one of the major things that we're going to have to shift. Also scientifically, a new set of research methodologies has to be invented for these new substances, because they're not just like every other pharmaceutical out there. We want to use psychedelics in combination with therapy, and that's not the normal way the mainstream psychopharmaceutical establishment tends to use drugs, you know, where they just kind of administer them, and they're supposed to, cure everything sort of on their own. Finally, a sort of larger cultural shift has to happen where, we respect people's ability to make decisions and, to decide what kind of substances they put in their bodies and don't. I think the war on drugs and the last 200 years of thinking about recreational drug use has put us in a spot where we think that anybody who takes one of these drugs that's defined as bad is really, a bad person, or is in some way faulty or lacking. Where in fact we could probably develop contexts in which it is safe and effective to use these drugs, and that's what we're working towards.
Right. Well, in talking to us about what MAPS is working for to create change, you've also given us a great roadmap for our discussion, because you mentioned how there need to be changes in politics, science, and culture. Mm-hmm. So let's actually start with the politics. I'm going to introduce my co-host here, Derek Yates. He's a pharmacology student. Derek's going to talk a little bit with you about policy and advocacy. So Derek, take the floor away.
All right. So Brad, continuing to focus on the politics in the United States, what sort of resistance does MAPS expect from the Drug Enforcement Agency as the prospect of a prescription psychedelic becomes more plausible?
Thankfully, when it comes to our psychedelic research in the United States, the DEA has been relatively open, relatively willing to grant us the licenses that we need to store and administer the drugs. So thankfully, MAPS' entire strategy is based around not going through the DEA and not going through law enforcement agencies, but rather going a different route, and that's the route of the Food and Drug Administration. So rather than coming at these substances from the perspective of criminal policy and criminal justice and punishing the people who are using them, MAPS is trying to, really look at them in a different light from the perspective of public health and treatment. MAPS was actually started back in 1986 after the Drug Enforcement Administration reacting to the huge increase in recreational use of MDMA or ecstasy, criminalized the substance, which actually shut the door on a lot of legitimate, very productive psychotherapeutic work and research that was going on with the substance. So MAPS was actually founded as a response to the Drug Enforcement Administration's refusal to allow research, realizing that was kind of a shut door. MAPS, our founder, Rick Doblin, in 86 decided that, we're going to go the health route here, because that's really where the cultural openings are in our society.
Well, now, is it likely that perhaps as these studies progress and the reality of the situation becomes greater and greater, is it likely that the FDA and the DEA will put their foot down?
Well, fortunately, we're at a point where things are looking very auspicious for psychedelic research. As we move forward with the research, we're also engaging in a widespread public education campaign. And we've been combating a lot of the fear-based propaganda that the government has been putting out over the last 100 years or so about these compounds, and educating the public about the about what the science says about the safest and most effective ways to use the substances for therapy. Acknowledging that there are significant risks to any drug, but also encouraging people that if they are going to go out and use these substances recreationally, that there are safer ways to do so. So, as we move forward with the research, I think overall public opinion is shifting, where MDMA is no longer just seen as this ravers, clubbers drug that people are going out and getting hooked on, but rather something that could be used in particular contexts very safely. And I think as that perspective changes, the potential for a backlash from the DEA or the FDA actually gets smaller and smaller.
Right. Now, has MAPS ever in its history considered moving its headquarters from California perhaps to a location with more accommodating drug laws as they pop up, places like Portugal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's a great question. Part of what we see that we're doing is actually working within the mainstream establishment. So the fact that MAPS is based in the country with, or one of the countries with the most punitive and harsh drug laws in the world, is actually what makes our work so important. If we can change how these drugs are treated within this system, then we expect the effects to ripple outwards as well. And it's interesting that you mentioned Portugal as well, because part of the work that we do is actually psychedelic harm reduction. So taking our scientific research and our expertise to places where individuals are using psychedelics in recreational contexts. Portugal hosts the Boom Festival, which is one of the largest electronic music festivals in the world. MAPS has helped set up and sponsor a psychedelic emergency services tent there, which provides a safe space to rest with medical professionals and people who are used to seeing people undergoing the kinds of crises that can be precipitated by irresponsible, reckless, or excessive psychedelic use. So, we are trying to move the knowledge that we're generating around to other places in need, but we're really trying to focus on reforming the mainstream medical establishment right here in the United States and other allied countries who are, experiencing similar drug laws and policies.
Right, Brad, that's fascinating that you've decided to take your mission to the eye of the storm, so to speak. And I love that you mention psychological harm reduction is something that you can export from the eye of the storm, because it's worth emphasizing that any drug used in a medical context can have side effects or can have the wrong dosage of use, right?
Absolutely.
And dosage is one of those things that you can only find out through research. So that's the next topic we're going to jump on. And the first research question I have is about what the difference is between research happening on psychedelics and on marijuana. Is one more progressed than the other, or is it more just that the politics are different? Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, it's really an interesting question, because ironically, it seems our psychedelic research has actually progressed much farther than our medical marijuana research. It's been far easier for us to initiate research on MDMA and LSD than on medical marijuana, which is fairly ironic just because of the difference in the numbers of people who report using these substances. You know, of course, compared to marijuana, the numbers of, people who are familiar with the effects of psychedelics is pretty small. You know, we have millions and millions of people all over the country and the world using marijuana and far fewer using psychedelics. So you'd expect it to go the other way. But we've actually been able to move into phase two clinical trials with psychedelics. We've now administered MDMA in the context of therapy to between 30 and 40 individuals now. By the time MDMA is approved as a prescription medicine by the Food and Drug Administration, we expect that number to be several hundred, at least.
That's great.
We've been able to move forward with the psychedelic research, but not with the medical marijuana research. We've actually been trying for 10 years to purchase 10 grams of marijuana from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. As I'm sure you are well aware, you could probably step out onto the street almost wherever you are in the United States and come back within an hour with 10 grams of marijuana. We've been trying to do that legally, above board, through the federal government for the last 10 years with no results.
So you're the only people in the country who can't find pot anywhere.
Exactly. And we're trying the loudest and the hardest.
Well, you mentioned the MDMA trials, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think these studies have been spearheaded by Dr. Michael Mithofer.
That's right.
All right. And tell us how that sort of study would work, because I think study is a very broad term, but as I looked up the abstract, it seems like it was very rigorous. For example, it was double blind. Mm-hmm. They did a 2-month follow-up. So tell us a little bit more about what it would mean to be in one of these studies.
Yeah. So these studies are actually called, they have a long scientific name. They're called placebo-controlled triple blind studies. Which means that the drugs used are always compared with the same drug, either of a lower dosage or a different dosage or a placebo. The ongoing study we have right now is actually using multiple different doses of MDMA in combination with therapy so that we can evaluate to what extent the dosage matters when it comes to the MDMA's ability facilitate the psychotherapeutic process. So, I can walk you quickly through this. Basically, what happens is subjects are enrolled in the trial. In the case of our ongoing one, it's all United States veterans with chronic treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of combat or sexual assault that occurred in the military. And they come in and they pass through the screening process. And the screening process involves psychological screening. It involves weaning off of any current medications the subjects may be on. It involves medical screening, so testing for cardiac or neurological problems that may that may increase the likelihood of complications with the administration of the MDMA itself.
Mm-hmm.
And then once the subjects have passed through that screening process and they're admitted into the study, they come in and they meet the psychotherapist. The psychotherapists are Dr. Michael Mithoffer and his co-therapist and wife, Annie Mithoffer, who's also a registered nurse in South Carolina. They both administer the therapy sessions. So in our studies, it's always a husband and wife co-therapist team. We've found that the combination of a male and female experienced co-therapists actually helps patients develop a greater sense of trust and rapport with a therapist, which is something that's extremely important when somebody is reliving traumatic memories of combat and sexual assault.
Of course, of course.
They go through a number of regular psychotherapy sessions where they're introduced to the therapist and they discuss their issues. They discuss why they enrolled in the trial, their previous treatments, what's worked and what hasn't, mostly what has not worked, which is why they're enrolled in the trial in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And then after several regular non-drug psychotherapy sessions, they come into the office one day. The Mithoffers place a single capsule of pharmaceutical-grade MDMA on the bedside table. So this is a clinical room. It has a couch and flowers, and it's nicely arranged with music and food and water available, a very comfortable space. The subject then takes the MDMA, and they go through an eight-hour course of psychotherapy
right
there in the room. Of course, ecstasy, which is, you know, the street name for MDMA, is commonly called the love drug, and you know, it's talked about for its feelings of euphoria, and people like to dance all night, and you know, these kinds of things. But one subject came out of our previous trial of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD and said, "I don't know why they call this ecstasy. It's not a party in the clinical treatment room." It's an opportunity for the subject to use the MDMA in a way that gives them the confidence and the trust in the therapist to actually go deeper into their traumatic memories than they've ever been able to do before. So it can actually be a very difficult and traumatic experience as the patient relives those experiences. And then after that is complete, the Mithoffers bring them some chicken soup and you know, basically make sure that, you know, the process of reintegration after the therapy session is occurring well. And then the next day, they're released into the care of a loved one or partner. That session is then followed up a week later by several more non-drug psychotherapy sessions. And then that process is repeated two more times. So for each patient, there's a total of three MDMA-assisted psychotherapy sessions.
Well, it sounds like you really have the full package of therapy there. You're not just focusing on the pill, but really making sure that you're helping people as well and putting it in a realistic therapeutic context, which is great. I do want to clarify that if someone's in the control group, that pill that they see on the table will not be MDMA, and I don't think Dr. Mithoffer will know that, right?
Well, this is one of the most challenging things about doing research with psychedelics, is that if you are paying attention, and the therapist and the patient are definitely paying attention, it's awfully hard to confuse a placebo with the real thing. If somebody has received a psychedelic, it's usually fairly obvious. It's hard to confuse the researchers, in other words.
Right.
In our first trial, which was completed in 2010, we actually did use a placebo. And we're not certain we were actually able to achieve an effective double-blind, just because of the obviousness of the effects of psychedelics. What we're doing in our current study now, instead of using an inactive placebo, is using a fairly new, a fairly innovative methodology for the pharmaceutical industry, which is the use of an active placebo. And what that means is just using a much lower dose. So that would be enough to cause some, you know, minor cardiovascular effects, some minor perceptual or cognitive effects without, you know, the full-blown MDMA experience. You know, in order to confuse the researchers, you know, confuse the subject about whether it was the full dose or the medium dose or the low dose, you know, but still, you know, have some activity there.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's fascinating, too, because you could look afterward when you have the data at whether their response is dose-dependent. So maybe exactly how much of the MDMA you give also shows exactly how much recovery happened. That could just be another good measure.
Exactly. That's exactly the goal.
Well, Brad, thank you for that summary. We're going to switch gears a little bit to you. We sort of want to know what attracted you to MAPS.
Well, I was I was very, very interested in, you know, the history, you know, as we talked before, of this distinction between, you know, the recreational and medical uses of drugs. And so I was studying this in an academic context, and I was, you know, at first very interested in medical marijuana and how that had shifted over time and how we were now living in a country where our understandings and our laws surrounding marijuana, you know, are changing so fast that it's hard to keep up with them. So I was trying from an intellectual academic standpoint to understand that. But deeper than that, what made it more powerful for me was that I had grown up, you know, in this society where pharmaceuticals were the answer, where, you know, children and adolescents, myself included, you know, experienced psychiatry and regular psychopharmaceutical treatment and never really felt like my problems were being addressed. I felt that I had experienced a lot of, you know, mainstream psychopharmaceuticals, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, and so on, but I never felt like I had been growing from them. I felt like they were, you know, relieving symptoms or just kind of smoothing over the waters. And I actually discovered psychedelics in what many would call a recreational context. After one of my own experiences with psychedelics very early on, I actually found that I no longer needed the prescription pharmaceuticals that had been given to me ever since I was very young. So there was something about the psychedelic, there was something about the level, the depth of personal insight that it afforded me. Of course, I was very, very fortunate to do it in a very safe context with a lot of supportive friends and family who knew, you know, the risks and effects of the substance. So my experience is not necessarily everybody's. And yes, I was very fortunate to have found that, and I wanted to. And this is why I ended up coming to MAPS. I wanted to create context, to help create safe context where the drugs could be used safely and responsibly, you know, not in a party context, not in an unsafe black market context, but where people could use the substances to actually overcome their addiction to, you know, prescription pharmaceuticals.
Right. So you're talking about, for example, a context where you know that the compound you're taking is pure.
Exactly.
You don't have to worry about those sorts of things.
Exactly. 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 And, you know, without those safe contexts, without that sense of security, without that knowledge that the drug you're taking is the drug that you're taking and that you have the kind of support to, you know, process the experience and understand the experience, you know, in a safe and productive way. I'm not sure that the psychedelics themselves can bring that. It's always about the combination of the drug and the context. So MAPS is about developing the context where the drugs can be used safely.
You know, you mentioned that MAPS is 25 years old, or at least you alluded to it because
right.
It started in 86.
Mm-hmm.
So let's look at what fed into MAPS, what sort of traditions and influences fed it. I'm going to let Derek talk to you a bit about the icons and scientists behind it.
Oh, great.
All right, Brad. Well, you mentioned that MAPS really had its cause of formation when the federal government decided to outlaw MDMA, And I guess the founders of it really found the need for its continued research. However, I'd like to go a few years before that and ask you how much success and how much of its mission does MAPS owe to counterculture icons of the previous century, such as Timothy Leary and Aldous Huxley and Ken Kesey, who helped to spread recreational awareness of the psychedelic drugs' effects and uses?
Well, right. Well, that list right there is certainly a very, very interesting one. And Timothy Leary certainly is, you know, the great, great, you know, godfather proponent of LSD. You know, if the question is to what extent do we owe our success to Timothy Leary, I would say not terribly much. There's a lot that Timothy Leary did to bring psychedelic research into, you know, major university contexts. However, we do feel that there was a certain overblown enthusiasm in a lot of these early countercultural icons. These drugs were relatively new to the Western imagination, and there were a lot of people who got very excited about their potential to precipitate, you know, massive cultural consciousness change. And that was, of course, very, very important in the 1960s, where there was a lot of economic and military, political, cultural turbulence that was happening already, and people were looking for something that would save them. Timothy Leary, sort of as one of the major outspoken proponents, and Ken Kesey as well, you know, really believed that these drugs would, in and of themselves, deliver us from our own fears and our own obsessions and paranoias and our own fixation on military conquest and so on.
Right. Now, that actually brings me to my next question, that if these psychedelic compounds had remained in the labs during their research instead of getting such early widespread recreational use, would the mission of MAPS have been easier to advance, or would we even see an organization such as MAPS? Would we treat these drugs as any other pharmaceutical that is, in the case of LSD, discovered in the laboratories of Sandoz?
I think that's right on. I think if there hadn't been the backlash, if there hadn't been all of this cultural backlash, which was in part a response to the overenthusiasm of people like Timothy Leary and Ken Kesey, you know, even though there were very significant, very positive parts to the messages of those early people, I don't think MAPS would have needed to exist. I think that the large amount of research and practice that was already occurring in the 1950s and 1960s with LSD and other compounds and therapy would have continued. And then on top of that, I think that part of the lesson of psychedelic-assisted therapy is that it's not just the drug that matters, but that there can be a collaboration between the drug and the therapy, or the drug and the context, or the set and the setting, as Timothy Leary himself put it, that creates the most extensive potentials for healthy change. So I think that if it had stayed in the labs and if the therapy had continued, I think our very concept of what psychiatry is would have been different today.
Right. Now, the one thing that those three men have in common is that none of them are chemists and none of them discovered the drug that they, I guess, really stood behind. Now, are people such as Albert Hofmann and Alexander Shulgin, did they find themselves active in MAPS at any time, or did they entirely precede the movement?
No, they did not entirely precede the movement. Albert Hofmann, who passed away a number of years ago, He was actually an enthusiastic supporter of MAPS. He very, very generously, in fact, and this is an interesting story, he sent a handwritten note to none other than Steve Jobs mentioning MAPS work and asking Jobs if he would contribute to research into the therapeutic uses of LSD, which Hofmann had originally synthesized. And as Hofmann put it, you know, please help convert my problem child, as he called LSD, into a medicine. So Hofmann did remain engaged, and he was enthusiastic to see the development of contexts where LSD could be used safely Hoffman was never a fan of the widespread recreational use that occurred after LSD was popularized, which is why he called it a problem child.
Now, what did Steve Jobs do in response? Nothing?
Well, unfortunately, the only thing that manifested from that letter was a half-hour conversation between Maps founder Rick Doblin and Steve Jobs, where Steve Jobs, you know, acknowledged that he was not going to contribute any financial resources, but that he was, you know, generally supportive of what we were doing. That connection was made, even though it never materialized into something material.
Yeah. Right. It's worth mentioning that with Steve Jobs' memoir out just recently, Steve Jobs does admit that he tried LSD and that he had some positive experiences with it. So,
Yep. He said it was one of the two or three most important things he'd ever done in his life.
Right.
Yeah, and you know, as far as Sasha Shulgin goes, who is the godfather of MDMA, who really popularized its use and who first began speaking about its possible uses in couples therapy and other kinds of therapy, he's still around. Last year, MAPS held a conference called Psychedelic Science in the 21st Century, where we held a tribute dinner to honor Sasha and his wife Anne. For you know, developing the concept of the therapeutic use of MDMA, so he remains active and very supportive of MAPS work, and MAPS in turn is very grateful for the you know, careful, rational, objective attention that he was able to put into the drug and really set a precedent for the future mainstreaming of psychedelic research.
Right now, personally enjoy Sasha Shulgin's books, P-Cal and T-Cal.
Yeah, wonderful book.
In which he documents his research of over 220 psychoactive compounds. Now, why is it that MAPS has narrowed its focus to psilocybin and ibogaine or MDMA and LSD instead of, I guess, researching the psychoactive compounds which chemists like Shulgin create, which are really created faster than the government can schedule them?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because our resources are limited. If we had unlimited resources and an unlimited number of clinical research teams, we would love to explore the safety and effects of any number of different psychedelic compounds. But because our resources are limited and we're trying to move the substances through the regulatory process as quickly as possible, we're really just focusing on a small number of compounds. We're focusing on MDMA just because it has the greatest potential of making it all the way through the FDA regulatory process. And that's both because of its long history of use as a therapeutic adjunct and because of its particular effects, which, you know, as our studies are now showing more and more, actually does lend it to use as an adjunct to psychotherapy for PTSD.
Brad, you mentioned that your resources are limited, but it's possible our listeners can do something about that. So tell us a bit about what listeners can do to get involved or support MAPS in some way.
Well, one thing I like to say is that it's not necessary to be a millionaire to help MAPS out, but it certainly helps. we're currently in the middle of a 10-year, $10 million plan. We expect that at the end of the next 10 years, MDMA will be available for use in clinical settings. So we'd like to move that through as quickly as possible. So, of course, financial contributions are especially welcome. All those resources go directly to our research and educational projects. We haven't had any support from major funders or from major grant-giving foundations or from governments yet. It's all come from private donors, you know, who are interested in seeing careful scientific research into these substances. So that's one way. The other way is a little bit easier, is just to, you know, start conversations with friends and family about it and to, you know, pay attention to the media reports that are discussing, you know, the scientific results, you know, and to educate themselves about the science, you know, to really know what a headline is saying when it says, you know, ecstasy use causes brain damage or ecstasy, you know, could be used in therapy, to really understand how the research is being done and how it's being framed by the media, because there's so much propaganda and cultural baggage attached to these substances that it's important to kind of step back and say, okay, what does the science really say? What does the media really say? and to have those conversations openly and honestly. You know, as long as we're talking about these substances in terms of fear and how they're going to hurt us, you know, we're not going to be able to really fully explore what their real risks are and what their real possible benefits are. So open conversations, financial contributions, also just getting in touch with MAPS. We're at MAPS.org, and there's any number of ways that people can host movie screenings or fundraising events or any number of other local community events. Just to get people engaged in talking about the research is really the best thing we can do at this point.
Right. Now, Brad, with the holiday season approaching, a little bit of spare time on our hands, do you have any suggestions for reading material that the people who have been interested by this conversation today can get their hands on in order to learn more about MAPS for themselves so that they can hold these discussions with their families and friends?
Yeah, certainly. Thanks for asking. MAPS does have an online web store. We have a number of books and other items, all the proceeds for which go directly to our research and education. Two books that I can certainly recommend. One is called The Pot Book by Dr. Julie Holland, who's a psychiatrist and physician, and also the medical monitor for a number of MAPS studies that contains a really, really great review of the scientific evidence about the safety and effectiveness of cannabis for a number of conditions. Again, that's called The Pot Book. The other one is called Ecstasy, The Complete Guide. That's also by Dr. Holland. And that contains a thorough review of the history of MDMA, past psychotherapeutic uses, what we know about the risks of it in recreational and therapeutic settings, and then overviews of what MAPS and other organizations are doing to try to mainstream the therapeutic use of MDMA. So those are two pretty good starts. They're really accessible. If you know a lot about pharmacology or psychiatry or medicine, they'll be really interesting reads. Also, if you're less familiar, they're still accessible. So those are two great places to start. And then, of course, there's Stanislav Grof's, famous classic LSD psychotherapy, which contains a lot of the methods and theoretical backgrounds to the therapeutic method that MAPS is developing for psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy.
That's really great, Brad. We're going to wrap up, but thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, Jose and Derek, it's been absolutely great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Just for the listeners, we've been speaking with Brad Burge, Director of Communications at MAPS. If you go to maps.org, you will not find Google Maps. You will find the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. Check it out. And the website for Psych Talk is psychtalkradio.com. Thank you so much, Brad, and thanks for listening.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you, Brad.
Take care. What do you think, Derek? Good conversation, right?
I think so. I think he's got a lot to say, and he's obviously very passionate.
Yeah, I was really fascinated by all these different nuances of the discussion of psychedelics. This strange paradox where psychedelic research is actually more advanced than marijuana research, but by some contortions of the law and culture, marijuana is coming out ahead in acceptance.
Right. Well, I would agree with Brad in saying that the most important thing that we can do is work on political change, because until that happens, this will be a really tough agenda to advance.
Right. And I think his point about conversations is important, because one issue that seems to be holding MAPS back, and the reason they're sort of the lone wolf in the eye of the storm, is stigma. Stigma among scientists, stigma among people in general. So, and it's funny because if you compare alcohol to marijuana, alcohol just hands down is more dangerous. More dangerous on the road, more dangerous off the road. That's my personal opinion. But if you look online into the research, I think you'll come to a similar conclusion. And yet if you say that to, especially I have sisters who are in middle and high school, and they're hearing the sort of DARE script on weed or pot, that sort of thing. And so they just can't believe I would say something like that at home.
You know, I've read before in the past that students who do complete the DARE program actually are more likely to try the illicit drugs, which it's trying to prohibit, than students who don't go through the program.
That is true. That's why DARE has died down, because it either had no effect or it got people interested. Thank you for listening to Psych Talk. Again, if you want to learn more about Psych Talk, check us out in Stitcher. That's a great way to listen to shows on your mobile phone or tablet. Check us out in iTunes. That's another great way to catch up on shows and have them automatically download into iTunes. And we're always at psychtalkradio.com. That's PSYCH, talkradio.com. radio.com.